If you're looking at your phone right now, you've found us on mobile, which means we can get a move on. You know me, you know what this is, so let's begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this hour, we begin with a really dumb idea. Let's say you have a problem in your home with pests. You've got all kinds of creatures invading your house. In your living room, they run. In the kitchen, it's a party. Bedroom, this is particularly disgusting and aggressive. Garage, a lost cause there, just like in the bathroom. And so, you take action.
Hello, I am Dr. Silo, head of the National Pest Institute, and we have announced a war on pests. We want to say that we have made significant progress in locating and slowing down the advance of kitchen pests. Thank you. And we're trying to unlock the much more difficult problem of living room pests. And we hope someday to be able to announce a treatment for garage and bedroom pests or the particularly terrifying, fast-spreading bathroom pests.
Excuse me, I have a question.
Yes.
In my house, I notice that I have mice and roaches. I've got them in the kitchen and the living room and roaches in the bathroom and the bedroom. I was wondering if it would be better to get something that goes after mice and something that kills roaches and not think about the room so much.
But you're just going to walk away from the progress we've made in the war on pests to pursue this highly speculative approach?
Well, no. I just think if you have mice, fight mice. If you got roaches, fight them.
And silverfish. I got silverfish. What if I just try something that kills all silverfish wherever they are?
I don't know if it makes sense to turn upside down an approach we've been using for more than a century. Going after individual pests based, what, on their specific genetic makeup? It sounds like something in medicine.
And that's the promise of precision medicine. Delivering the right treatments at the right time, every time, to the right person. And for a small but growing number of patients, that future is already here.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's not every day the Commander-in-Chief shows up in your little dream sequence, but he is talking about a very smart idea for the old war on cancer, which has made progress but maybe needs a rethink. That's what precision medicine is all about and why it's very different from what President Richard Nixon declared back in December of 1971.
The Congress is totally committed to provide the funds that are necessary, whatever is necessary, for the conquest of cancer.
This week, the National Cancer Institute announced it would begin a new kind of clinical trial that reflects this new precision medicine idea rather than the old Nixonian D-Day, hit the beach, war metaphor idea. This trial groups cancers based on genetic identifiers, no matter where they live, instead of treating tumors based largely on where they are in the body, lungs, kidneys, liver, that sort of thing. Dr. James Dorshow is leading the new study. He's director of the Division of Cancer Treatment and Diagnosis at the National Cancer Institute. He joins me now from the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. Welcome, doctor.
Welcome.
Would you say that precision medicine is specifically shifting away from location in the body to something much more unique to the specific cells that get involved in cancer?
We're trying to utilize the information about mutations in genes and other molecular abnormalities to specifically direct treatment without regard to where the tumor was initiated.
Is that to say that different kinds of genetic cancer are, in a sense, different organisms in some way?
Well, I would put it this way to give you a specific example. Recent information from a large project called the Cancer Genome Atlas, which has analyzed the molecular makeup and the mutations in many different types of human cancer, demonstrated that a proportion of patients with cancer of the uterus, on molecular analysis, those tumors look much more like cancers of the ovary, and they respond like cancers of the ovary. That wasn't appreciated even 5 years ago.
What do you think accounts for the fact that while there are obviously reasons why lung cancer occurs in the lung based on external factors, perhaps, and that liver cancer occurs in the liver because of the specific physiology of the liver, why would there be this mixing of certain genetic characteristics that could show up anywhere in the body?
Well, let me give you an example, and you used lung, that's a good one. Another good example is melanoma. Both of those tumors, if you look at the degree and range and depth of mutations that you can analyze from large numbers of patients, are at the top of the list. And if you think about it, melanoma, the worst kind of melanoma, is directly related to ultraviolet radiation. The kinds of lung cancer that are most sensitive to targeted therapies against specific mutations are diseases that are related to carcinogens. And so I think that there are different kinds of carcinogens, but across a range of those, we get patterns of significant mutation that really are targets of opportunity for therapeutics.
And let's talk about how challenging this new study is going to be. You're going to group cancers based on genetic identifiers. Do you think there's going to be some sort of cultural resistance in the sense that someone who has lung cancer wants the best possible treatment for lung cancer, and someone who has liver cancer wants the best possible treatment for liver cancer, and might be a little nervous being grouped with someone who has something that up till now has been thought of as fundamentally different?
So you might think that was the case. However, the way the study is organized, we basically recommend that patients get the best appropriate treatment that is known standard of care for their illness at the beginning. The study is organized and will be specifically targeted to patients who do not have further standards of care to be offered. So the patients who will enter the study really have already had what is most appropriate for them.
Can the pharmaceutical industry develop treatments quickly enough to be matched to individual patients? And will there be enormous investments that go into the cure or treatment of a small group of patients with genetic identifiers that then would be useless for a broader population?
Well, actually, this study could not go forward if we had not assembled something that has never been assembled, at least to my knowledge, before, and that is an arsenal of drugs across 20 different companies. 40 different drugs are going to be, at least that's what we've organized so far, but there will be more, because I think the industry has figured out that even these small subsets of patients, and in the future, most diseases will turn out to be not just lung cancer, but one of 20 or 30 different kinds of lung cancer, that this is the way we're going to develop treatments. And so they've been very active in working with us to try to see whether such a study on a national scale could actually be mounted and what the results might be.
Is there resistance in the research community? I mean, the war on cancer and the approach that we've used up until now has certainly had some success. It's reached some plateaus and some dead ends as well. But I'm wondering if the entire grant infrastructure and the way in which we do cancer research is able to turn on a dime here if this proves to be a much more promising approach.
Well, I think that one of the things that I'd like to point out is the genetic information that that comes forward and is produced by the biopsies and the analyses that are done will be made available worldwide. And so that one of the reasons to structure a study like this, and one of the reasons for the NIH and the National Cancer Institute to conduct such a study, is to try to demonstrate whether or not the risk involved in thinking about changing our paradigm is actually worthwhile, and so that the government should take that risk initially, and if it looks favorable, provide the information that will assist the research community as they move forward to different kinds of approaches.
Now, I know you're a doctor, but we began this segment with a little dream sequence, and I wonder if you could dream with us a little bit and share your sense of the outer vision of this customization approach in medicine beyond even cancer. What do you see happening in, say, the next 50 to 100 years?
Oh, Could you give me 5 or 10 years first?
Give me 10. Give me 10.
Okay, give me 10. Give me 10. I think in 10 years, it will be routine that every patient who has surgery for a presumed malignancy and every patient who has a biopsy for a presumed malignancy will have detailed molecular characterization, not only the mutational analyses that we're moving forward with in this trial, but actually even more sophisticated studies of RNA and protein that will help us to a great degree in determining how the treatment should be administered.
And
you know, I probably both of us won't be here in 100 years, but one could speculate that, in fact, we will have blood tests that can detect very early on the possibility that might have there might be malignant cells in some organ that can't be detected yet, and that there will be treatments that will utilize those molecular alterations to eliminate them.
Dr. James Dorshow, it sounds very exciting. He's the director of the Division of Cancer Treatment and Diagnosis at the National Cancer Institute. Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
High-profile sexual assault cases on college campuses in the past few years have triggered dozens of federal investigations and a call for reform on Capitol Hill. But when a student makes an actual charge of sexual assault on a college campus, the process of finding out what happened still takes place in no open court of law, but instead in front of school officials in a closed tribunal where there are few rules.
One question that we had was, and this is going to sound kind of bad, but we're not perfect in reviewing medical records, and there was no reported bruising on the arms or anywhere else on your body outside of that pubic region. Is that accurate? Would you want to respond to that at all?
The only things I noticed were in my inner thighs.
I just want to clarify that you were feeling pressured throughout this entire experience?
Yes. Okay. Very pressured.
Okay. I would like to know an ideal outcome.
I think it's expulsion. That's the highest level that the school can do.
The only reason you are hearing the sound of an actual college sexual assault tribunal from the University of Arkansas is because a team from Vice News got a hidden camera and microphone into a place that is neither open nor formal, part of a Vice HBO documentary segment on how the growing problem of college sex assault cases is being handled and what it's like for assault survivors. Gianna Taboni is a correspondent and producer for Vice on HBO.
I was listening to the hearing in real time, and the survivor that was in the hearing was very emotional throughout, and the questions were not easy questions to answer. But I would imagine when going through an investigation, whether it's through the criminal justice system or a school's adjudication hearing, that there are going to be questions that are going to be difficult to answer because, of course, it was a traumatic experience that this person went through. However, on Monday, we were in Washington, D.C. for a screening, and I sat down with Senator McCaskill and Senator Gillibrand, and they are really experts in this area. Senator McCaskill was a sex crimes prosecutor. They, created legislation for military sexual assault, and both of them scoffed when I asked them that. They said this was terrible. The panelists were not properly trained. And that's one of the things they said. This is a perfect example in your documentary. This is one of the things that we're trying to change.
What do you think the institutions are trying to do, either rightly or wrongly, to keep the facts from getting out, to keep this under wraps?
I mean, I think Senator Gillibrand said it best in our documentary, which is that a lot of schools really care about their public image. They care about their reputation, sometimes over the well-being of their students. So definitely there are some schools that have changed their policy and presidents who have spoken out, committing themselves and their schools to change. But there are definitely a lot of schools that either have changed their policy in a way that hasn't created change on campus or have not created change in their policy at all. One of the things I heard survivors say was, you know, sure, my school has changed the policy, but they didn't talk to me about it and they didn't talk to our organization about it. We're the people at the center of the issue. They should be consulting us.
Statistically, the idea of a sexual abuse victim on a college campus is not confined to women. But in this particular story, because of the nature of the survivors that you chose, did you get a sense of how widespread or how seriously this is taken by male students on campuses?
You know, I didn't. It's all sort of anecdotal evidence for me being on campus. And actually, one of the more frustrating things in producing this documentary is that there aren't a ton of bulletproof statistics. Being on campus, though, you know, I think it would be wrong to say that male students aren't don't take this seriously and aren't committed to becoming educated on how to prevent these crimes from happening. So, yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, unfortunately, we're seeing this culture of rape all the time with new news articles about, for instance, last week, Penn State had to suspend a fraternity for 3 years because fraternity members were found to have been uploading pictures of unconscious nude women at school. And, you know, it's horrifying, but that's something that has almost become normalized because we're seeing the reports with such frequency. But I think it would be wrong to say that male students don't care. I definitely talk to male students who do care about this issue.
And you say that one of the difficulties here is that it comes down to the account of one person versus the account of another person. How difficult is that for you as a journalist to reconcile?
Listen, I think it's really difficult as a journalist and also as, you know, to adjudicate these crimes for schools. It comes down to one person's word against another. There isn't a lot of hard evidence just inherently in these cases. As a journalist, I did as much as I could with the great team that we have at Vice to corroborate all details we could. But at the end of the day, we weren't there, you know, and no one was there besides the two people. So you can never say this happened, which, you know, of course we didn't. But yeah, we went to great lengths, and thankfully we had months to produce this documentary. So we had a whole team of people that was, you know, that worked to corroborate both of the cases that we featured.
What does Title IX do in this whole situation? Does it help or hurt?
The idea of Title IX is great. It's there to protect students against discrimination based on their sex and create, you know, a safe environment for students to receive an education. But there are certain flaws. For instance, if a school is in violation of Title IX, the law says that they have all of their federal funding taken away, which that has never happened because it's implausible that will never happen. And so part of what is in the bill that the senators are proposing is that it would actually just be a percentage of the federal funding that the school receives, which, you know, is a lot more plausible.
And why is Title IX an issue in cases of sexual abuse?
Because if the school doesn't create a safe environment for a student, for instance, if they don't properly handle a case of sexual assault, then that student is being deprived of an equal education.
And Senators McCaskill and Gillibrand, who you talk with in this documentary, believe that the federal government has a role. Do you think students embrace a federal role here and colleges embrace an actual federalization of essentially campus dating?
I mean, listen, it's controversial. I think survivors are thrilled that the federal government is stepping in and trying to create change and proposing this bill. I think that they feel that if that pressure isn't put on their universities and the administrators, that nothing is going to change and that their voices won't be heard. And then on the other side of things, you know, Senator McCaskill said it herself, there are a lot of universities, there are a lot of presidents who are not thrilled with us getting involved and they want no part of it. So listen, it goes both ways. I think that this has become such a big issue across the country that I think it's a good thing that the federal government is getting involved.
John Timoney is a correspondent and producer at Vice on HBO. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
The Vice on HBO documentary Campus Cover-Up airs on HBO Friday, June 5th at 11 p.m. Eastern Time.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing users with tools to create websites for small business or their own personal brand. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway. And Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like physics, photography, and parkour. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at curious.com/PRI.
This podcast of The Takeaway is brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International. I'm John Hockenberry. Our partners include WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and The New York Times. If you'd like to know more about the program, you can find out more about me and the team at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Sexual dysfunction is apparently a man's world, with manly billion-dollar drugs like Viagra for erectile dysfunction, but not much for women wanting more satisfaction with their partners, as this real public service announcement suggests.
So, it's just you and your lady. The setting, it's magical. But then, erectile dysfunction comes knocking again. But lucky for you, you have countless medication options that will make you just as randy as a teenager. Too bad your lady doesn't have any. Even though more women than men suffer from sexual dysfunction, there isn't one available medication on the market. Sounds like we've been left high and dry.
That's an excerpt of a possible ad campaign put together by an advocacy group called Even the Score. They're advocating for the FDA to approve a daily dose little pink pill called flibanserin for women who have difficulty with sexual arousal. The FDA is holding hearings for the drug today. But the gender equality argument may have an uphill battle at the FDA. The prospect of women buying a drug like Viagra with the same enthusiasm as men spend on ED drugs could be distorting the more basic questions of science. Thea Caccioni is an assistant professor of women's studies at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. She's writing a book called Big Pharma, Women, and the Labor of Love.
Really, this drug has been submitted 3 times, once as an antidepressant drug and twice as a treatment for low sexual desire. It's been rejected every time by the FDA. And the people who have bought the rights to flibanserin, Sprout Pharmaceuticals, have an extensive background in public relations and marketing, and they've done an excellent job of kind of shifting the conversation away from the evidence and the science and trying to make this the fact that flibanserin has not been approved about something else. They're basically charging the FDA with sexism. So very clever marketing move and very heavy public pressure they've now put on the FDA. But the science and the evidence remains the same. This drug does not have an adequate risk-to-benefit ratio.
I mean, does it have any even remotely credible benefit involving female sexual desire? I mean, what does it do that might produce that benefit?
Yeah, I mean, this is the fascinating thing about flibanserin is the benefit is so minor, if any benefit at all. In the European clinical trials, there showed basically no benefit. In the North American clinical trials, there was an extra 0.7 sexually satisfying events per month when participants took flibanserin as compared to the placebo. The placebo, actually, in all of these trials, had quite a positive effect.
Given the charge that medical research in general has maybe not focused on women as much as men in a whole variety of domains, do you think it is a worthy mission to try to find a pharmacological solution to some issue of enhancing female sexual desire? And has there been any or an appropriate amount of study of the matter?
Excellent question. So I think the first point that listeners really have to understand about this is that millions and millions of dollars have been spent by drug companies on this pursuit. Ever since the minute Viagra was released to this kind of blockbuster success, it was the most lucrative drug since Prozac, I believe. There was immediate organizing in the medical community. There were consensus conferences on how to classify and define female sexual dysfunction. You know, there's been so many different drug hopefuls in the pipeline. There was a Procter & Gamble testosterone patch prior to this that made it to the FDA approval stage, but was not found to be safe or effective. So it's really not a case of lack of trying by any means. In fact, what I understand is that sexual desire is much more likely to be influenced by external factors, by relationship issues, by psychological issues, how you feel about yourself, but also about the social world, the way that we have kind of constructed norms of desire in ways that are not always realistic for all people all the time. So when I get asked that question, you know, is this a worthy pursuit? I would like to think in an abstract sense, sure, but I'm actually not surprised that despite millions of dollars spent on this pursuit, this focus on physiology is actually not proving to be very fruitful.
Without getting into high school health class here, Viagra is not an orgasm drug, of course. It just enables a particular function, erection, that it certainly increases the likelihood that someone's going to have an orgasm with their partner if they're a male.
Right.
If there was, it's a bit of an apples and oranges comparison, but if there was discovered a physiological trigger for female orgasm, do you think the FDA should, as a matter of equity, take a look at that? And do you think it's even possible to find such a trigger that would be comparable to what Viagra does?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think the FDA will look at any drug that is submitted to them with, you know, the adequate research protocol followed. So I don't think there's ever going to be a concern about the FDA dismissing sexual pharmaceuticals as a category. And they've really
although I should say, I mean, the FDA does have a problem with ideology in other drugs, you know, birth control drugs and that sort of thing. I mean, the idea that the FDA is purely objective on pharmaceutical issues that are important to women is suspect.
Well, I think it's quite the opposite, though. I hear what you're saying, but I think the opposite has been true, that if anything, there have been drugs approved in the past that were not safe for women. And the birth control pill, which was initially 10 times the dose of estrogen it is today, was not safe. And it was really the work of feminist grassroots health advocates that got the FDA to recognize this and encouraged the inclusion of warning labels within pill packages. I don't think it's so much a matter of the FDA not allowing women to access enough drugs. If anything, I think they have to be cautious because there have been so many unnecessary drugs. I'm also thinking of thalidomide, DES for miscarriage, which led to all sorts of birth defects. If anything, I think there's that history to contend with.
Thea Caccioni, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thea Caccioni is an assistant professor of women's studies at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. She's writing a book called Big Pharma, Women and the Labor of Love.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
Where does something genius like this song, released 50 years ago this week, come from? This is not a Mozart story of scribbling down genius on manuscript paper. It's more like Keith Richards falling asleep on a bender while jamming with the tape recorder running. Music historian John Kovac told The Atlantic that when Richard listened to a fully recorded tape long after his hangover, all he heard was a lot of snoring. He actually didn't remember recording anything, but for a few seconds, there it was on tape, the basic melody and riff to this, one of the greatest rock songs of all time. John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our partner station WNYC. Welcome, John.
Hi, John.
I gather the creative technique of being nearly comatose is not confined to the Rolling Stone.
Although the amazing thing about the Keith Richards story is that somehow the next morning it still sounded as good as it did the previous night. That rarely happens.
That's magic. That's magic. All right, so there are some other examples here.
Well, you know, one of the most famous examples, not so many years after the Rolling Stones, is Iron Butterfly and their one and only hit, the 17-minute-long behemoth that we know as In a Gotta Da Vida. In a Gotta Da Vida, honey, don't you know that I'm loving you? In a Gotta Da Vida,
baby, don't you know that I've always been true? Now we don't have to listen to the whole 17 minutes.
No, we don't. And In a Gotta Da Vida occurs at the beginning and the end. In the middle, it's mostly instrumental, a good thing, because apparently the singer was drunk or high or both and slurred the words in the Garden of Eden. What you're hearing, in fact, wasn't supposed to be recorded. This was a sound check. The producer hadn't arrived, and the band was just kind of vamping in the studio, but the engineer was rolling tape. and at the end of it decided, hey, this is actually pretty good, whatever Inagata DeVita is.
Creating an infinity of arguments between people at parties going, no, it's in a Garden of Eden, man, for sure, I know it, I know that. So, you know, that's the way it is, that's for sure. All right, some other examples.
Another example, and a kind of a similar one, is perhaps the most famous piece by Booker T and the MGs, the instrumental vamp known as Green Onions. I mean, this was, again, a case where the band is in the studio, and in fact, here they're waiting for a singer. A rockabilly singer was supposed to come in and do a jingle. They're in the Stax Record studio in Memphis. Singer's late. So the band's just kind of riffing on stuff in the studio, and Booker T has been playing this piano piece, tries it out on the organ, and the engineer once again is rolling tape. Now, this is 1962. Tape is expensive, but the engineer is also the owner of the studio. And the result is a classic. And the postscript is, it was released as a B-side.
Oh, fantastic. Now, this next story, I think, seems very, very plausible here.
Yes, Burning Down the House by Talking Heads. David Byrne had this habit of, you know, creating a song and having what he called a mumble track, where he would just kind of mumble syllables, words, whatever kind of fit the line of the melody. It wasn't necessarily to make sense.
Which explains a lot of the Talking Heads lyrics.
Maybe. Right.
They're sort of fit in there to support the music.
In this case, in the case of Burning Down the House, the mumble track worked so well with lines like, 365 degrees burning down the house, that they just kept it.
That has total meaning to me. There's also a kind of a mumble track in one of the bridges where it goes.
there's a lot of wooing and hawing in some of those early David Byrne songs. I asked him once if he could write that way now, and he said, oh no. It's a completely different kind of technique of songwriting.
Now, do you think Burning Down the House was the original intent of the song? Something about Burning Down the House? Or is even that, it's like a mumble title?
I think he probably had the title and then was just kind of, you know, lyrically vamping in the studio. And then it stuck.
Now, this kind of thing would never happen with the Beatles, right?
Well, you know, the Beatles were always so careful about what they were doing and so considered in what they did. The Lennon-McCartney thing we now know was often either Lennon or McCartney, but A Day in the Life was a case of Lennon and McCartney each having half of a song and not knowing how to finish it, and then kind of stitching it together in the studio. The stitching, the stuff that weaves together, John's tale ripped from the headlines and Paul's tale of nostalgia for his commute to school, is the orchestra. But that's not what it originally was. They didn't know how they were going to weave these things together. So in the studio, they had their assistant counting out the bars. And then an alarm clock, which signaled, all right, now we go to Paul's song.
Woke up, fell out of bed, dragged the comb across my head.
All that was supposed to come out, but the alarm clock stayed in. They couldn't edit it out. And of course, it's the perfect lead-in to Paul's line, woke up, got out of bed.
Fantastic. Give me one more.
I'll give you one more. The song that brought rap music to the world, Rapper's Delight.
I said a hip.
By the Sugar Hill Gang. Right. There was no Sugar Hill Gang. This was producer Sylvia Robinson, who had had a previous hit with Pillow Talk, a kind of schlocky early 70s light rock number. But she had heard about this hip-hop thing, and she had these musicians who were playing the riff to Good Times, and she wanted people to do this rap thing over it. And she couldn't convince any rappers to come into the studio because they were all it was a live art form. It was done in the clubs. Mm. Her son finds a guy in the local pizza parlor and drags him into the studio. That guy turns out to be the late Big Bank Hank, who actually had to borrow lyrics from another early hip-hop artist, Grandmaster Caz, and that's what you hear in Rapper's Delight.
It's a great story.
The song was done in one take, 14 minutes long, then they edited down the radio version.
And next time when you come back, we'll have examples of shows you did after you were wandering around.
They were all done that way.
John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our partner station, WNYC. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Here's something to take with you today. The takeaway is subscribe to our podcast this weekend on The Weekender, which you get automatically on Saturdays. If you subscribe, you'll hear a preview of our interview with Michael McConnell and Jack Baker, a gay couple who obtained a marriage license in Minnesota back in 1971. Check out thetakeaway.org for more info and for all of today's stories. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. All I'm here to do, ladies, is hypnotize. Sing it on and on and on and on and on.
The beat don't stop until the break of dawn. I sing it on. Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.